I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, friends. How are you? Long time no speak. Welcome along to Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. My absolute professional pride and joy, where I have the best time having these conversations, and I very much hope that you enjoy listening to them. So today we've put up two episodes. The first of those that we put up was with Edgar Wright, and I explained what happened, that the fact we've got this other episode that you're about to listen to. I'll just give you the very short version of it. I was on my way to the Battersea Power Station Cinema to host a Q&A with the wonderful Chase Infinity. She plays Willa in One Battle After Another. And as I was going up the escalator, I just checked my phone, and there, like a shiny beacon, was an email from Mr. Johnny Greenwood, who said, "Sorry for not getting back to you." Why is he apologising? He's in the middle of a Radiohead tour. Anyway, I had emailed him a couple of weeks ago and just said, well, I'd emailed him when the film came out and said how amazing it was and how brilliant his score was, and said, if you want to come on, I'd love to have you back on. He said, I'd love to. I was like, well, you might be a bit busy because you've got your band drawn tour. And then I emailed him a couple of weeks ago, just checking in. And then I got this email going, sorry, I've not been in touch, but do you have time at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning? Yes. Even if I didn't, I would. You're Johnny Greenwood. So if you've seen One Battle After Another, you will know that the score is so important to the film. And it starts with score. You're in it because of that. There's so many textures and layers and wonderful motifs and themes throughout the entire score. I think it's definitely one of my favourite Johnny Greenwood scores. And it feels like it's almost everything that he's previously done with Paul Thomas Anderson has led to this particular score. It's so good. And as we discovered from Edgar earlier, which I hope you listened to, The Running Man and One Battle After Another have a musical connection. Namely, that they both feature The Revolution Will Not Be Televised by Gil Scott-Heron. But we are here to discuss Johnny's incredible score. So, without further ado, let's get cracking with this cue from One Battle After Another, The French 75. Listen, I felt like Christmas yesterday when I got a little ping in my inbox from you. So kind of you to spare the time to talk to me, especially in the middle of, you know, where you are just now in terms of on tour. So thank you, Johnny.
Of course, it's over to you.
Weirdly, I was with Chase last night, Chase Infinity. Yeah, we were doing a Q&A last night. So she was quite excited when I told her, because I kind of came bounding in after just getting your email going, I'm chatting to Johnny tomorrow. So she was like, I've met his daughter, but I've never met him. So I'm like kind of totally excited. Or she'd met someone in your family, I think. Anyway, I don't know where to start with this film, because you start it, you know, in terms of, I remember going in to watch the film at Odeon Leicester Square. Massive cinema, massive, brilliant sound system. And that kind of title track starts, and it's the start of the journey before we meet anyone, before we know where we are. It's got such an impact on us, and it's a beautiful piece of music. What was your starting point with this? When did Paul start talking to you about it? And yeah, what were those conversations?
It started with a script and just lots of discussions about, I'm trying to remember. I mean, it was very much a case of me writing lots of music for the characters and for the story, mm-hmm. and refining it as he started shooting, and then getting things more in line with the tone of the film. I mean, you think I'd be used to it by now, but Paul's films have this strange, they're very, very funny, usually getting at something terribly serious. It's a strange pair of worlds to straddle, I think. But at the same time, the last thing you want in his film is comedy music of, you know, pizzicato and lightness, because it's already there. It's already very funny and fast moving and all of these great qualities. So he's keen for the music to be about the story and to not be in any way ironic, which is great for me.
It's interesting because I can't imagine, like you say, he's got such a unique tone of his films, and it kind of embraces so many genres, and it dances through genres as it goes through the film sometimes as well. And how he's able to take us from one emotion to another in the space of, you know, one scene, one sentence sometimes. How does that read? Does it jump off the page with that as well, in terms of you can get that sort of real unique tone that he's given you from reading the script? Does it come out like that?
It does. To the extent where you think, how is this going to work? How is that not going to be absurd? When he's describing the, you know, the Christmas adventurers meeting in a basement. But it's just becomes believable, is not quite the word. You just fall into his universe, don't you? It becomes engrossing.
You've worked on a number of films together. This relationship goes over, you know, a good few years. And this film's been something that's been circling around him, his brain, for a number of years as well. Is it something that he's talked to you about, you know, in the past, about this project? Or does he hold it kind of close until he's got it in a place where he knows he's on that journey?
He seems to go from having one or two sentence thing that he keeps talking about, and then suddenly there's a whole script. Yeah, I think he plays it quite close until it's sizable enough.
I'm interested in that kind of, you know, when you say you're writing to script to start off with, is it immediate for you in terms of kind of instrumentation around tone, characters, emotion, I guess? Because the way the piano kind of starts this and those beautiful strings come in, but then as we go through the score, it's such a variation of tonally and music, and rhythm as well is such a brilliant thing, I think, in this score. Does it jump out to you when you're reading the script in terms of instrumentation, or is that on a bit of a journey as well, in terms of till you find what feels right?
The first cue you hear is just an exercise in tension, because it's you have the singing music where you can suspend a note. It's like called a sus4 when you play it on a guitar or on any instrument. And it was about trying to keep that note suspended for a whole piece of music to make you feel, hopefully, that lack of resolution. I'm always interested in music that's about building up tension and trying to keep the tension there. And I suppose that's what all good music does. It kind of, you know, it's fundamental to so many kinds of music. You know, when the bass drops out of a song and comes back in, it's all about you're waiting for that to happen. So, and I think that's always been kind of a very traditional approach to music making. And so that's how I wrote that. And it was just variations of that idea. That was the main thing. We'll be right back.
then going on that journey of, because you know, when we talked in the past, you were saying that kind of you love performance in terms of seeing the performances and also responding to that, and the journey that a piece might go on from initially having an idea after reading the script to maybe seeing a daily or an early edit of something, and how that's changed and informed things. Was there a big shift in this from script to scene performance?
Yeah, I mean, there was even shifts during the whole process of giving people music. There's one scene where Lockjaw goes to break down a door. Well, he goes to see Perfidia in her safe house.
Yeah.
Bunch of flowers, can't get in, goes back to the car and comes back with a battering ram. A different kind of way of breaking in, I suppose. And so I had to write four different things before we got something right, because again, I suppose I felt it was too comic. I just saw it as something that was sort of quite light, and he just gravitated to more and more darker and more serious music until we finally, you know, wrote the right thing.
As a film fan, though, when you've read that script and then you get to see how, I mean, this cast is extraordinary, and the performances are all just, I mean, Sean Penn, you mentioned there, his character. What was your reaction to seeing those characters brought to life?
I mean, selfishly, it's really exciting because it makes the music sound so much better. You have that thing of just, you feel like you're contributing a little bit to what's already an amazing performance or amazingly shot film. So that's how you know it's working, is when you're not taking anything away and it's, you know, it's bringing something.
Well, it's interesting with Sean's character, because there are elements of it that there's no dialogue with him, you know, in terms of that physicality of the character are telling us so much about him, you know, especially that kind of the end scene and that walk that he kind of created for that character is just so terrifying. That's going to be a really exciting part of what you've done for this film, is being connected to that character in those moments when there isn't dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, Paul's first suggestion was military music, so I listened to lots of marching band things. There was even one early idea I was trying to foist on Paul of recording it all outdoors, because that's a very strange acoustic. These marching bands, you hear them, you know, standing in a parade ground and playing, but that's quite a well-trodden path. You think of like Private Benjamin and all that style of COD military, American military music. So that was a bit of a dead end, but that's the kind of discussion we have months and months and months before, you know, anything gets filmed. We just,
oh wow,
that's in a way the most fun part, is knowing that you can go in any direction and just you end up listening to styles of music you would never normally listen to, and usually find things which are amazing and really worth hearing and worth knowing about. And don't ask me for any names of these bands I've never but you know, found old records of, you know, of American sousaphone bands and stuff. It's all quite interesting.
I know that that's kind of, I mean, the whole process of that, it was lovely chatting to you last time about your, you know, genuine excitement of the opportunity of working with new players or orchestrating and arranging and that whole side of it, as well as, you know, as coming up with the ideas. But the research side of it is, I find kind of really fascinating, you know, in terms of you as a musician kind of learning and exploring new worlds that you might know of, but you might not know in any great depth.
It's a total sweet shop. I mean, if you the technology of music making and centuries of, you know, ideas and approaches and a whole world of cultures, it's just, it's so endless that it just feels you're just stepping into an enormous sweet shop each time. And it's just incredible. Plus, I've started getting over the embarrassment of using my very watery fame to be able to write to people and say, can I get some advice or help about this, and to get replies from people, which is huge privilege.
What were some of the kind of, I guess, the explorations that you went on with this? You talked about the kind of military band side of it as well. What were some of the other places that you explored, both in terms of, I guess, working with specific players or just kind of areas of music that you kind of lent into?
Well, it led to this idea of military drums, and I got these old, you know, those slightly creepy guys that do war reenactment, like the Seal Knot Party. And
yeah,
there's also a whole world of musicians alongside who have
recreated
the drums and recreations of. So we got some of those drums. But rather than getting any humans into play, I built these mechanical hitters that are made of solenoids that you control with a computer. And
wow.
A sort of ghost percussion group in the room next door, just with all these drums on the floor and all of these cables leading to my laptop, and just wrote software to emulate all of this. And it's very clunky and goes in and out of time, but it ends up sounding more kind of more realistic, I suppose.
Mm. Built all that?
Yeah, well, me and Plank, who Radiohead tech, and it's really fun. And occasionally they fall apart, and I'd have to go in holding one against one of the cymbals and another one against one of the other drums while Graham's in here recording. And it was again, it's very amateur hour. And I think Paul did come and see some of the tail of it and just watched me operating Pro Tools on my own in horror. Very scrappy and inept way it was all being done on his hugely expensive film, and it all ends with me in a small dark room in Oxfordshire, slightly out of my depth on Pro Tools, trying to editing audio for him. He found it hilarious, and luckily,
did you keep him away from the drums this time?
Oh, he's an awful drummer. Shocking. Should have heard him. Really, Sir Barton didn't know where to look. Constantly takes the piss out of me. He's learned very quickly that the way that the British express affection for each other is by being extremely cruel. So it's like that. He's got a very British sense of humour, I think. That's kind of one of his secrets.
Yeah, for sure. Did you use Stephen Bennett on this score?
Stephen Bennett?
Yeah, your cello.
Yeah, it's Stephen on there. Wow. Funny you remember him. I think only it's a percussion instrument. I think maybe I'm hitting him or...
Oh.
Yeah, he's quite abused, really.
Stephen.
Yeah, he's usually only got three strings on him. It's not a happy life. I keep promising myself I'll go and get a real cello and spend, you know, which is that kind of paranoia musicians get where they think, well, I have some money now, really I should treat myself like a musician and go and get a real cello. But, you know, I think it's fine. It sounds as good as I can play it. So that's the main point, really.
Stephen's a real cello. Maybe has three strings, but he's still a cello.
It's the handwriting on the label. I will send you a photo of it. It's so much like, you know, a loving parent's lowercase writing of their children's name. It's something really endearing about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to talk about Perfidia as a character, and both in terms of her presence, but then not her physical presence. And if that idea of, I don't know if it is something that you wrote into your music, but that character obviously only kind of is with us for a certain section of the film, but her presence, it continues throughout the film, you know, in terms of, and I wondered if that fed into anything that you wrote.
I think that's why the scene in the safe house took so long to write, because that is obviously Perfidia disappearing to Mexico. That's the build up to that. And I think Paul wanted to make it clear that that was a big deal, that this was something pivotal happening in the film, rather than just Sean Penn's character being inept and amusing. And so that's why, I suppose, that cue looking back, I haven't thought about this until you asked that, really, but I realise now that's why that cue in particular just got bigger and heavier and more foreboding, I suppose.
What kind of themes of the film do you think you connected with the most? You know, you've got that kind of father-daughter side to it, you've got the kind of the revolutionary, there's so many kind of elements to the film that kind of come in and out, and there's obviously some that run through the entire film, but you know, when you were reading that script and you, there are things that you kind of connected with in particular, were there any of those?
I mean, I loved all of the scenes showing Leonardo DiCaprio's character frustration with the underground, with the kind of dogma of everything, and all the humour in that. I just found very sort of accurate, because I know that frustration. What else resonated with me? It's really about a father and daughter, isn't it, this film? It's about Bob. It's about Bob's, you know,
bumbling through.
Totally bumbling through. Even at the beginning, when he's supposedly a revolutionary, he's just putting, you know, fireworks in the ground, and it's, you know,
from a wheelbarrow.
I know. It's all through net, you know, including him. I mean, like he says later in the film, you guys are so sort of, yeah, again, it's so comic and yet has all this serious stuff alongside it. It's very clever how he does it.
I wanted to ask, there's a bit of a random one as well, like, it's called River of Hills, that cue for the kind of that extraordinary car. It's not really a chase. It's a kind of a chase, you know, across that unbelievable landscape. And I was thinking about the kind of idea that if that had been shot in a town or a city, how different the experience would have been for us as an audience watching that, because it does make you feel really nauseous when you're watching it. You're kind of like really disorientated. But also in terms of writing music for that, if it would have been completely different had it been in a different landscape and environment.
Well, it's totally different because it was done by Hugh Brunt conducting to match the incline of the hills. So
as, oh, wow,
up and down, the strings are going up and down in pitch to match that, to try and make you feel extra queasy.
That's amazing.
And that's why it does that. I wanted to do it so that it also sped up and slowed down, so it felt like there was more effort as you're going up the hill and
yeah,
the acceleration you're going down. But when we tried that, it was just too exhausting in the wrong way. It took some of the excitement out, I suppose, to have the momentum of a chase. But yeah, I mean, it's a real gift seeing that, you know, as a wave on paper, and thinking of how that could be, you know, transcribed for the musicians to play.
From the LCO.
It is, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the kind of decisions about who you worked with on this, you know, in terms of working with those guys and working with specific players and things as well, because there's some beautiful kind of solo moments throughout the film as well, in terms of, you know, is it you playing like with like guitar for Willa, or those moments with the violin as well? It's, yeah, that's a lot, yeah, of questions, sorry.
Fine. I mean, it's really interesting talking about this because I really haven't thought about it or talked to anyone about it since doing it. So it's all kind of coming back while talking, which is no good for you, obviously. I'm going to
It's perfect.
The way you say that. Let me, I have no anecdotes lined up, but I can tell you about, so Guitar for Willow, that's like a solo nylon string guitar thing, because another idea that came from Paul was like Latin American nylon string guitar music, mm-hmm, like Baden Powell.
Brazilian guy.
That's right. So I tried writing some cod Latin things and sent him, which he really liked, but we both felt it was too straying too much into pastiche world. And so I fell back, as I kind of keep doing, on Baroque music that's vaguely Spanish.
Mm.
And or it just became, sounds very Spanish as soon as you play it on a nylon string guitar. And just wrote some music in that style for him. Yes, lots of it. He found a few places in the film to use that. So that was a case of him suggesting a kind of music, me writing some music like that, and him finding out how to make it work in a few scenes, and then asking for some variations of it to me. So it's very back and forth and long-winded.
Is it you playing?
Yeah.
It's really lovely. I like the simplicity of it. I mean, it probably wasn't simple, A, to write it or to record it, but it's really effective.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, I quite often make the mistake of putting too much music all the way through and everything being too dense. So yeah, it's a reminder that sometimes, you know, it's so great to have some space.
And then working with Hugh and the LCO, you know, and when you need them, and when, you know, like the Guitar for Will is just you, but it's kind of when you know that you need a kind of, you need more people, you need an orchestra, you need more players as part of different cues. Is that kind of pretty obvious, I guess, as to when you get to the point where you know what the piece is and needs to be?
Yeah, there's lots of talk about scale. So Paul will say, we need big ass strings at this point. And sometimes the middle ground as well. There's a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio's character Bob is alone, smoking a joint in his house and getting more and more paranoid. So that was totally written to scene and to picture, to the extent that I even wanted every inhale to be... I mean, obviously, I've never smoked any kind of... Neither of you, but I understand that sometimes when you do...
Partly.
feel that your head is sort of... expanding
like a balloon,
yeah, in a not very nice way. So again, that's a really nice brief. So it was about how can I write a few minutes of music that feel like that, and especially feel that moment of inhalation where everything is just slightly wrong and slightly paranoid. So that's what that music is trying to emulate, that feeling.
What's that cue called again?
It is called... I don't know, do I?
Come on, it's your record.
Well, you can't call it, you know, Stoner Bill or whatever it's called. Or,
I was going to ask, actually, if you get to name the cues.
You do. Yeah, well, Paul's very good at names, so I usually rely on him for lots of it. I don't have it on my...
Oh, don't I've got it here.
mean? It's about halfway through. It's an it's called something like The Fear or... Yeah, I need the greeting code, Bob. There you go.
There you go. That's what it is. Who came up with the title like Tom fucking Cruise then?
Well, that's in the... That is in the script.
Yeah.
That's what Sensei says. I'm all for putting as many words and phrases from Paul's script into the film.
Benicio's brilliant in this as well. Oh my God, what a great performance.
I know, I keep telling friends, I wish I had someone like Sensei in my life. Wouldn't it be great?
I want a spin-off film. I want a spin-off Sensei film.
I want a series, come on.
I kind of feel like, oh, I just would like you to write, like there just to be more music. That's actually something I wanted to ask you, because there's so much music that you've written that doesn't make it into the film or onto the score sort of thing as well. The idea that for characters that have, you know, for Lockjaw, for Sensei and stuff, the idea that you could release a kind of a bonus soundtrack of that character for music that didn't feature in the film.
Yeah, I mean, that does tend to happen. I think one of the self-indulgent things that I keep falling victim to is that towards the end of finishing a soundtrack, I will feel like there could have been other versions of a certain track. And if there's time at the end of a session, I will present players with different arrangement and say, we've just got 20 minutes, let's try and do a version of this. It's not going to be in the film, but we'll put it on the soundtrack, which is very hugely self-indulgent and doesn't happen that often. But when it does, it's really exciting to kind of just hear. Because the point is, when you write a theme, that's sort of the end of its shelf life. And it's been frustrating in the past to think, that would have been really nice on piano. It would have been nice to have done a version. So more and more, I'm kind of getting the chance to do that. And I've got amazing players like Eloisa Fleur-Tom, who's the solo violinist in the LCO for this recording. And she does a solo version of one of the themes. And it's just amazing. And it's nowhere in the film, but it was just, you know, the privilege of getting to write something for a player like that is motivation enough. You hand these people, you know, a sheet of paper and they do that with it. It's just floors you every time, really.
Does it still?
It's unbelievable. It's just, I don't know how you can get used to it. I suppose if you did it day in, day out. But even then, I just, there's nothing like it. Nothing like the room full of musicians, or even just a musician in a room. Just, it's mad. It's insane. It's like, it's something magical that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Did you still write this with kind of pencil and paper?
Yeah, that still feels the best way, just because it's like the River of Hills one. The fact that that's going up and down in pitch feels like an idea that happens more easily when you're working on paper, just because strings are really fluid and time is very fluid, and all of these things become rigid as soon as you have, you know, something that starts with a tap of a space bar on a laptop. You just feel constrained, and yeah, paper is just, you know, for me anyway, still better.
Yeah, it just sounds like you get something out of every stage of the process of working on a soundtrack, like whether it's, you know, writing on paper, or whether it's hearing a soloist interpret what you've written, you know, give it their talent and their craft into it, seeing the finished kind of version of it. It sounds like as a creative, you get something out of every stage of the process. Is that fair?
Well, I'm very indulged because I have the time, and I'm not in the situation, which I'm sure you've heard lots of composers are, where they're just, you know, there's a list of producers who have to sign off on every cue and give their opinion.
Yeah.
Everything has to be changed or to be made to sound more like the demo. And then eventually the demo is used, and all this sort of nightmares, or the demo that they're using is a copy from another film that they were asked to. It's so, you know, I hope I realize that it's a very privileged position to be in, which is partly why I write so much, maybe. And it's a kind of greed in a way. You just want to just write loads, record loads, find out all the information you can about this kind of music and luxuriate in the time you have, because you hear all the horror stories of this needs to be done tomorrow, and it needs to be, you know,
yeah,
overnight, and people don't sleep for days and days and days to get there to meet these deadlines. And it's a very unproductive and uncreative thing to do.
Did Paul play any of your score on set at all? Do you know, like stuff that you'd, any stuff that you'd written ahead?
Yeah, I think he played some of the mechanical percussion things to people, and there's lots of mechanical piano things as well that are all involved. Now, it's a real kind of ghost orchestra, because you'd go into the room next door and the piano would be playing itself and the drums would all be playing themselves.
How's the piano play itself? Did you do the same thing for, like you did for the drums then?
Yeah, it's all mechanical too. Looked at it in the wrong way, it's really idle of me, because but no samples at least. It's not, you know, that always, I'm getting old fashioned because I'm sort of working on paper and trying to not use samples of anything, but that always feels a little sort of cheaty. I think I'd rather have slightly crappy sounding self-recorded drums rather than perfectly recorded samples, I think.
Yeah.
But that's narrow-minded too. You should really be happy to use both and either and everything. That's what I keep telling myself. It's funny, I'm always reminded, I've might have told you this before, but I did an interview with Yvonne Loyer, who was an On Martineau player, played with Messiaen in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s. It was an amazing musician. I kept telling her how the On Martineau is the most amazing electronic instrument and nothing is as good at it. And she said, no, synthesizers are great too. Keyboards are great. They're all good. And she was in her sort of late 70s explaining why I was narrow-minded. And she was exactly right. And I think about that advice all the time. And here's me sort of bad-mouthing samples. But obviously samples are amazing and can be great too.
They'll tell you when they need to be used, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
I want to quickly ask as well about Trust Device, because I love that cue. Can you remember Trust Device?
Yes. So originally he wanted two alarms that play together. So I said, well, that's a real waste, because you could have something which doesn't sound like a melody until two things are connected. And again, that was really fun project, because you have to write something that sounds really banal and another thing that sounds banal, but then together they become a harmonic thing. There was even a suggestion that we should, as part of the promotion, we should have some exciting app where people's phones, you know, would do that for real. never got around to it. It kind of works. If you listen on the soundtrack, it's left and right, so you can hear that, you know, on their own, they do sound like just a mobile phone going off. You don't hear any of the harmony until they kind of combine.
Okay. I was driving back from work, from doing the thing with Chase last night from sunny Swindon, and my car journey home is about 45 minutes. And I had it in the car. I love just like being on my own in the car and cranking music. It was so great listening to the whole album through, you know, from start to finish in the car. And you just kind of, you know, the sound quality in a car is kind of quite luxurious, and you get to hear things, the clarity of it. So brilliant. So yeah, I totally had that last night with Trust Device. So that's why I wanted to ask you about it, because I just think it's so incredible how the music connects in such a level with what's going on in the story. You know, you're talking about that the Trust Device, which is a physical thing within the film, that and but the music is mirroring or trying to kind of, it's just it's kind of so clever. And I think, you know, on surface level, we just sit there in the cinema and I know that we shouldn't be sitting thinking about things too deeply, sort of thing. We should just be enjoying the experience of being in the cinema and what the sound and the music and the visuals are doing to us and making us feel. But to be able to kind of like actually sit down and think about it, it's extraordinary the level that goes into how we feel when we're watching it in the cinema? That wasn't a question. That was just a rant.
it's just mad the effort involved to make a film happen, isn't it? Reminded of that great Mitchell and Webb sketch. Someone explained where they're going on a tour of seeing how Doctor Who is made.
Yeah.
And explained, he just said, well, then it's not worth doing, is it? I mean, it's not. It's pretty good, but I mean, it wasn't worth all of this. But, you know, the hope is that it is always still worth all that effort.
Definitely. And this is definitely one of those instances that is crying out for a live music playback of the film. Could it be done?
That's very nice, but I think you would be watching, you know, the Ghost Drum Orchestra for the whole.
Great.
Well, me running out to kind of.
You holding up cymbals.
Pretty much like that. It's not that reliable. The little rubber washers keep flying off the end of them. The faster they go, the more they break. It's like a lot like that.
Could be an installation.
Could be an installation. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it could. Wow, that'd be so complicated. I mean, it's a nice idea.
It's a great, wouldn't it be, mate? It could travel around the world as an installation. That would be so great.
And poor Kat Tinker, who's the pianist, we had to notate some of the piano stuff that then she had to go and learn how to play. And it had all been sort of constructed with very shonky, homemade Mac MSP software. Make all these patterns and shapes and don't repeat. And again, you know, you put these pages in front of her and she can, and her fingers can do it. And obviously make it sound far better and far more interesting. So there's that side to it all as well.
Yeah. The piano feels like quite a prominent instrument throughout the score.
Yeah, again, that's led from the mechanical stuff. But then we also did things where you put the piano out of tune while it's playing and you have notes sliding.
Yeah.
Which is a really disconcerting thing because you're so used to pianos being something you can rely on, something that's very static in pitch.
Can you write like that untuning, or is that just kind of something that you do whilst you're recording or playing?
You have to slightly cheat, but you notate which notes you want to move and how far. And it's very involved and takes a long time. But the eventual sound is of someone playing a chord on a piano repeatedly, but just one of the notes is moving and it's really nauseating, hopefully in a good way. So that's what we used a lot when Willa, the daughter, is being interrogated by Lockjaw in the chapel.
Mm.
And it's all becoming very serious. So, yeah, that's why I think that works.
Yeah, it's so good. I just wanted to say as well, I was chatting to the wonderful Lynn Ramsey on Friday night about her her new film. And I think you started something with her that I'm so glad that she's kind of been encouraged to explore with this film. When you did Kevin with her, I mentioned last time we spoke, you mentioned it where you'd kind of, she'd suggested like some either instrument or musical ideas to you sort of thing. And on this film, she's singing, she's, you know, she's very much part of performing in the score or music in the film. And she's so kind of modest about it and doesn't like talking about it. And, you know, kind of, but it's so effective. It's kind of, you know, it's even more putting her stamp on her creativity in that new film.
She's talented. She's an amazing photographer as well as everything else.
Mm.
In her pictures, it's really, she's the real deal.
Yeah, and she's talked so highly of working with you as well. It was just, yeah. It's lovely to hear that kind of, you know, that kind of mutual respect and how you come away from, you know, even being accomplished in your field, how you still come away from working on a project and you still learn from people and you still take things away from those experiences. And she was, yeah, she talked really highly of that those experiences with you, for sure. What about you? Do you feel like that? Do you kind of, even though you and Paul have worked together, you know, on a number of films and, you know, different musicians and things you work, have you come away from this project with, I don't know, having learned something or discovered something or?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time I've had to write proper underscore, because there's a scene when it's all kicking off with the ICE agents in Backhand Cross, and that cue had to be like 22 minutes long, and that's not something I've ever had to do. And I mean, that was really the inspiration for the mechanical percussion, I suppose, was how do you keep something that's intense and yet not program anything, not rely on, you know, Ableton or Pro Tools, whatever. So that was the motivation for that, really. And underscore is really hard because it needs to sort of not assert itself too much, but also give you propulsion, but not be too repetitive and all these sort of qualifying things. And just keeping a track on something that's that long and for it not to be too abstract, that was a new thing to try and learn how to do. Plus, I got to do my first car chase finally. So excited.
What's your favourite car chase bar this one?
Bar this one? Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing beats French Connection, does it really? I mean,
yeah, French Connection or Blues Brothers for me.
Sure. That was totally... enjoyable, although not as fun as I was hoping, because it just turns out to be really serious and traumatic. Still, it is a car chase.
Tick that one off. Did you go on set?
No, it was all in California. I wasn't going anywhere near, I'm afraid.
No.
Go to Phantom Thread for one morning when they were filming in London. But I think that's the only time I've been on set when Paul was working. And again, it just felt like you're in a very small terraced house in the middle of London with 200 crew members all standing in stairwells trying to get out of each other's way and cables going everywhere, and it wasn't a place to hang out and feel the vibes at all. It was just like, this is lots of hardworking people trying to do their best to make something work, and we should go.
Yeah, same. I've not been on many, but the few times that I've been, it's that thing where you get asked and you don't want to be rude by saying no, but then when you get there, I just feel so uncomfortable and just kind of like, oh God, I feel everywhere I stand, I'm in the way, and just kind of like, just want to disappear. It's like, oh, it's awful.
Yeah. I even got an invitation from Jeff Green. I'm using his fake name from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
You got invited down to Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I did get invited, yes. But again,
wow,
it's one of those things that's nicer to have had the invitation than to do, just because I would have been overexcited and in the way. And but I got a signed script, which I'm very excited for. I know, signed by Larry David.
No way!
No, that's like, it's a thing I'm easily proudest of.
Wow, if you got it framed somewhere.
I should.
Was it in a drawer?
Well, yeah. What's mad is it is genuinely 4 pages long, and each scene begins with, you know, Larry gets out of the car and has an argument about parking space, then scene two. So it's just all improvised. It's just all this, there's hardly anything there, and they turn it into those amazing episodes.
Wow.
Yeah, he's another genius, really.
Maybe get it framed. What's next? Well, I know we've got a tour to finish, but yeah, after the tour.
Next year, genuinely no idea. Nothing planned at all. I'm finishing some orchestral music.
Oh, great.
The Halle Orchestra in Manchester, who are amazing. And I'm just trying to finish something for them, for Daniel Piero to play. Now, Daniel Piero, he's like a violinist who started with the LCO, and he's been on lots of soundtrack. He's all over Phantom Thread.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to write for him.
That's the thing I want to learn more about is those kind of, you know, those players and the orchestras. There's so many kind of amazing collections of musicians, and just sort of try and dig into that a bit more and learn more about those, the collectives, but also the individuals as well. Those, it's kind of my New Year's resolution.
Yeah, there's so many great young orchestras. It's a whole universe. You should totally explore the Manchester Collective, And then there's 12. It's just, it goes on and on.
We're very lucky, aren't we? Take it for granted of all these incredible musicians that we are. They need to be celebrated more, for sure.
Yeah, nothing like live music. I get more and more disappointed with microphones and speakers. I think it's, you know, it's always more exciting to be in a room with players. Even you're just going to see a, you know, string quartet or any kind of local music. The most fun thing to do is on a night out is to see what concerts are on in whichever obscure American city you are. And there's something happening. There's some amazing little group playing. It's just, it doesn't take much effort, and it's always rewarding. It's always exciting.
My son, who's 12, he plays French horn and drums, and even, you know, kind of going to the school concerts there. He goes to school in Gloucester, and so Gloucester Cathedral's there, kind of like chapel sort of thing. So going in there as well and hearing that organ, or even like, you know, like when the kids play like the Christmas concert or the Lent concert, all that kind of stuff. It's just, it does something physical to you. It's amazing. It's kind of, you kind of come out feeling taller.
Yeah, same here. We have Evensong in all the Oxford colleges, which again is something that people don't really know about or don't seem to go to, but it's just, you can just walk in and hear these incredible choirs. There's nothing like it, really. It's something about human voice and choirs.
Yeah. Did you use voice on the soundtrack at all?
No, I never have.
Oh, wow.
Never have. It's like, it's a bit like brass. It's not something I really understand, but I keep meaning to try and learn more about.
Thank you so much for chatting to me today. I love chatting to you. It's brilliant. Thank you so much. So appreciative of your time. Get another string on Stephen Bennett and give him some love.
It's funny because it's true. It's all so true. He's genuinely...
He's half naked.
It's awful. So cruel. Yeah, you inspired me. I'll go and rescue him right now.
Take care. Thank you so much for your time. It's lovely to chat to you.
Likewise.
From the score to one battle after another, that's Avanti Q, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Mr. Johnny Greenwood.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A huge thanks to Johnny for pinging me an email on a Monday, on his day off of a Radiohead tour, to say he was available for a natter. I very much enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed listening. You can still find screenings of One Battle After Another in some UK cinemas, and it is also available digitally now as well. So get along if you can. Just get on board and watch it if you haven't already. If you want to hear my previous chats with Johnny, PTA or Sean Penn, you can head to edithbowman.com, where you can find all 500 plus episodes of the podcast. Soundtracking UK is our handle for socials, so please do give us a follow if you aren't already. And be really amazing if you could subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is called Soundtracking Extra. We put so much great extra content up there for you guys to dive into. We had the amazing team behind I Swear. We've got James Wood coming up talking about Malice, Jed Carzo talking about Tornado, Echo Valley and Monkey Man. And I also have a beautiful conversation with Tahar Rahim, who's a phenomenal actor. You'll know him from things like A Prophet, The Mauritanian, and his new film's called Alpha. It's out in cinemas now, actually. You should definitely go and check it out. But my chat with Tahar will be up on our YouTube channel, Soundtrack and Extra, in the next couple of days. So just go and subscribe now, then at least when it drops, you'll be notified. Next up, though, on Soundtracking, we're finally bringing you my chat with Guillermo del Toro and Alexandra Desplat. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.